Often we talk about freedom and ease. Sometimes called names like Nirvana, means the a fire gone out, the coolness after a fire gone out, and this ease is could be defined as the end of all grasping, holding, clinging attachment, which is this term upadana in Sanskrit, means grasping, and also means like sustenance or fuel. So it's related to fire. In old India, the understanding was that fire basically was active, dependent on its fuel, and it kind of the fire energy would cling to the fuel, like the wood, and when it separated from the fuel, it would go out. That's maybe not exactly how we understand fire now, but something similar to that. So this word upadana can mean grasping something, grasping, attaching, clinging, holding to something, you know, physically, but usually our problems are the mind is holding, grasping something. And it also means like the fuel itself, like the sustenance that keeps the fire of bondage in the cycle of discontent burning away. So when grasping ceases, peace and freedom manifests, is realized. We could say, especially from a kind of Mahayana perspective, that this peace and freedom is the actual nature of each of us, and the nature of the whole world is Buddha nature is already perfectly free and at ease. So we don't need to create some kind of freedom and ease. It's not already here. We just need to unveil it, realize it, reveal it, and it's just obscured by the basically attachment. Grasping is the main thing that obscures our already peaceful, compassionate Buddha nature. It's like the sun is already always perfectly shining. It's just obscured by these clouds of grasping. We don't need to make the sun any brighter. Just dissolve, see through the clouds, let them drift off, revealing the bright sun. So tonight I thought we could look at different types of grasping. Maybe not the most fun topic, right? Because this is like, let's look at how we're holding on. But I think it's a great topic because our freedom and peace is right there at the point where we let go of what we're holding on. So in order to let go, we have to see where we're holding on. And so it's not so much like, let's really get into what a horrible situation we're in of grasping. It's more like, let's really take a look at different ways we might be holding on so that we can release at those particular points. So one list the Buddha offers, these four types of grasping in the early foundational teachings. Could be taught in various orders, but let's say, first of all, a type of grasping to where one can let go is grasping the view of an independent self. This might even be the foundation of the other three. It's kind of one of the really foundational core teachings of the Buddha, that the proposal is that we hold this view that we exist in some way independently, or we have this essence that's like our true self is this maybe hidden, maybe obvious, some independent core that doesn't come and go and doesn't depend on conditions, and is almost like indestructible. So the Buddha taught there, that type of self we don't have. Whenever we get into the teachings of no self, it's a tricky topic because it's quite a subtle teaching. Because obviously we say, well, this is me and that's you. There is a kind of a self, right? It's we could say self is kind of shorthand for our body and mind experience. Our body, our senses, our feelings, emotions, the way we conceive the world and think about things, our impulses and unique personality tendencies, the way we react to things, dependent on past conditioning, our actually consciousness itself, all of these aggregates, these areas of body and mind, you know, we could loosely call that, that's me, but there's no, in all of that experience, there's no actual independent essence. There's just experience, experiencing itself. That's kind of who we are. And for shorthand, we like give each other names, so we don't have to say, oh, this body and mind experience over here, we'd like to ask that body and mind experience over there a question now. We say like, I would like to ask you a question, you know. Just, it's shorthand. But then we take that shorthand, convenient terms, and we feel like there really is somebody here in addition to the body and mind experience. That's the strange thing that we naturally do. The proposal is we're born with this very subtle, you know, attribution where, of something here in addition to our experience that we call me. Yeah. So, and it's okay to use it as a kind of convenient designation to say, I am Kokyo. But then if we think that's more than just a continuously changing body and mind experience dependent on all these other conditions, dependent on all of you and all the past events of this body and mind, to think there's something more than that, is this fundamental view of an independent self. And we can, we might have heard these kind of teachings many times before and think, yeah, I can understand how that's, there's nothing there really, so I don't hold that view anymore of an independent self. But, so there's a, sometimes it's spoken of, there's like the innate view, and then there's a kind of learned view. So it's maybe not that hard to, it takes some work to hear these Dharma teachings over and over and reason about it to see like, oh yeah, I can see that it's not, I can make sense that there's just an experience happening because I can't really find this essence of me in addition to that. But that would be kind of like a learned view, and we kind of undo the learned view through learning this Buddhist Dharma. But then there's this innate view that's like, that reasoning maybe starts to get at, but it doesn't really get at it often. Because we can see, we're like, I really don't believe there's an independent self. And then somebody will say like, you know, why did you just do that, you know. You're such an idiot, you know. And then immediately we feel like there's something in addition to our body and mind experience. We're like, how dare they say that to me? They insulted me. You know, I know there's nobody really here in addition to the experience. But it actually, it's not fair. They said, you know, how could they say this to me? We see that attribution of that somebody extra. That's like the innate one. That even if we conceptually understand these teachings, we still are holding this kind of very invisible kind of view. We don't even know we're holding it, and things are going well until we're insulted, accused, especially falsely accused. They say, if you want to locate the view, if you're wondering if you have it, just wait till you're falsely accused of something, and the self will rise up and say, defend me. Or other ways we can locate this, the view. It's kind of funny to call it a view, because we could say, well, I don't hold that, you know, philosophical view, but on a deeper level, the proposal is we're still holding a view. And so ways are like, the way we kind of separate, either identify with or separate from our experience. So like my, you know, we stub our toe really hard in a rock. Oh, my toe! It really feels like there's a body-mind experience of pain going on, but there's this extra step that we're identifying. That's my toe! And, you know, there's a me that owns the body, right? There's a self that's owning the experience. And then we maybe immediately after that think, that was so stupid of me. I can't believe I wasn't looking where I was going and stubbed my toe. And then we're like, now we're separating the self from the mind that was, you know, was careless and stubbed the toe. So the self is somehow, we separate it out. We do this very naturally, with no effort at all, right? We're born with this ability to separate it out and then feel like there's a me that actually has a body and mind. And we talk this way, and it feels very normal to say, yeah, this is my body and my mind. But if we look a little deeper, just ask, well, whose? You say, it's mine. Well, who is this owner of the body and mind? Well, it's the... if we start to look at that simple question, it starts to become a little bit strange, right? Well, I don't know. Is there somebody in addition to the body and mind that owns it? But yet we often speak like, it's my body and mind. So this is this view of an independent self is we hold this view. It's a kind of grasping. We not even notice it's grasping, but just the fact that we hold it, and it's quite difficult to let go of because it's hard to even see it. But that's one type of grasping that keeps us. That it's like a cloud that blocks this shining sun of our true, free, selfless nature. It really isn't an independent self. But we somehow imagine there's such a thing, unconsciously imagine there's such a thing, and then hold that view. So through understanding these teachings, going over it again and again from many angles, and could easily talk about this the rest of the night and the rest of the week, because it's a subtle and vast topic. Leave it at that for now. That this is maybe the basic grasping. We have to see through this view, especially the innate view, and that there was just body and mind experience with no owner, no self that owns it, no self inside it. It itself is not a self, and so on. So then the next kind of grasping the Buddha listed in this list of four is kind of funny. You might think, well, this is a kind of, seems like a sort of minor thing. Why did he make it its own category? So it's quite interesting. I think this one is basically grasping precepts and practices, particularly spiritual practices. It's in a way, it's another kind of view. And I think it's quite an interesting one. It's kind of like, this is applies to practitioners, but also maybe to people who don't have any spiritual practice. They might still have kind of some maybe superstitions that they actually believe. So in a way, this is pointing towards the belief. I think we could call the whole thing in a way belief in superstition, but it's more precisely defined as believing that that any kind of precepts or practices in and of themselves will lead to complete liberation and freedom from suffering. So it's quite interesting. Buddha even, it's called in Sanskrit, Shila Vrata Upadana. So Shila is the term the Buddha used for precepts and virtue. So this doesn't mean that then we don't have precepts or practices. The Buddha had, was totally into Shila and Vrata, precepts and practices. But if we take single out any one of them and say, this will be the cause of my freedom. If I just practice this completely, that's all I need to do. He's saying that's kind of like a kind of a spiritual illusion. Quite interesting. So it looks like originally he was talking to all these other, Indian practitioners in his time, many, many spiritual methods and practices going on, and he felt like a lot of these seem like they're misguided, like a lot of people practicing intense austerities, and like there was one group of ascetics in Buddha's time, it was called the Dog Duty Ascetics. And their practice was to actually act like a dog as closely as possible. So they would, as a kind of austerity practice, so they would go around naked and they'd walk on their hands and feet. They'd crawl around and they would eat just, off the ground. They couldn't pick up their food. So they try to imitate a dog as a kind of like, it sounds maybe pretty strange to ask, like, how is this being practiced? But I would understand it as like they're just completely letting go of all like social conventions. Maybe they feel like we're too attached to social conventions, like eating out of a bowl and stuff. So like, let's just radically do this whole different thing and just be like a dog. And also maybe a very simple life. You have a very simple life with so we don't have to get distracted by a lot of busyness. Well, dogs have a pretty easy life, so still we don't know the details of what this sect believed. But one time some of them came to the Buddha because they heard this Buddha is a great teacher. Let's check out our practice with him. And so they crawled up. Blessed one. Gotama, we're the dog duty ascetics, and what will be the result of our practice? Maybe in the next life, if we practice this austerity really fully, we'll be born like a heavenly realm. And apparently Buddha first, he didn't want to answer. He just kind of smiled at them, and they kind of pressed him a little further. No, really tell us with your divine vision and understanding, what would be the result of this practice? And Buddha was like, well, if you really want to know, chances are highly likely that if you're born into this next life, you'll probably be born as a dog. Because you're creating the conditions for dogness. you're creating these, basically karmic patterns that like when you wake up tomorrow, you'll if you've been doing this dog practice for 10 years, you're probably take it up again, and your next life it'll probably happen again. So, you know, I don't really recommend it. So that was an example of like grasping a practice that if you just do this one practice completely, you will you'll realize complete liberation. And usually, you know, he was kind of poking at these other traditions, but I think to be fair, it should be applied to Buddha's tradition too, right? Grasping precepts and practices in the Buddhist tradition. Again, doesn't mean don't practice them. Do practice them wholeheartedly. But if we grasp them, like say the precepts, if we say, if I just follow these bodhisattva precepts in our Zen tradition, nothing else, just really wholeheartedly, that will be lead to complete freedom from all discontent. I would say, you know, it goes a long way. It will lead to some freedom. That's why we do practice them. They do have a function. They do have a result. But it's not the whole story. Like the Buddha taught, sila, precepts, and also samadhi and prajna. This kind of threefold training. And you need, they all three work together. So if you just single out the precepts and say that's all we need, it's not quite complete. Or samadhi. Just sit zazen. We might say maybe this would be Dogen's thing even, right? Just sit zazen night and day, never leave the cushion, and you'll be completely free. I think if we take that in some narrow way too and just grasp that as the only practice, this is also grasping precepts and practices, in parentheses, as in and of themselves being the sole cause of liberation. I think that's the actual meaning. So, and prajna, maybe we actually need to enact prajna through precepts and samadhi, but I think a lot of these types of grasping are pointing towards what we really need is clear understanding. It's so important, this prajna or wisdom that actually discerns, well, what is the point of this practice anyway? To be able to look really deeply and is this really leading to liberation? We might even try things out and give them a chance, but it might feel like in our own experience, no, actually, I've been doing this for a long time and it's not really, I feel just as stressed as ever. And maybe we're, you know, try something else instead of just blindly continuing. It's a tricky issue. I think this is quite a subtle thing because we talk about faith. So sometimes we just take a practice on faith or trust because we trust the teacher who's giving us the practice or the Buddha who's recommending it. And so I think and Dogen also talks about faith or trust as the basis for just sitting. Faith in Buddha nature we need before, you know, kind of it's a prerequisite for shikantaza, or just sitting, Dogen says. So we just have to be careful that it doesn't become like a blind faith of just do this, and that's because we heard it's the way, and that's enough. Buddha is really into really deeply investigate your own experience and see what actually works, and have a wider view, maybe no one thing. It's maybe a little suspicious if we take any one thing and say, just do this one thing. We need a kind of well-rounded, balanced practice, like precepts, meditative concentration, and discerning wisdom. It's a nice, well-rounded, we could expand that to the Eightfold Path and various other models. So, any kind of like spiritual superstition, we have, and I would say we have plenty of it in Zen. I mean, what is like, you know, chanting something, and what is it to dedicate the merit, to transfer merit to other beings for a well-being ceremony? So we have to really look, is this superstition, or are we just doing it as a wholehearted practice? And do we feel like that will save the sick person? Maybe they don't even need to go to the hospital if we just chant wholeheartedly enough for them. Maybe that's not so balanced. Maybe they should go to the hospital and we'll chant for them. Because maybe just going to the hospital is not enough either. Maybe we actually do need the chanting. Yeah, I think superstition is an interesting thing to look at. All spiritual traditions have various, almost magical sounding practices. The mantra of great wisdom. If you recite this, you don't need even the rest of the sutra. So how do we understand that? Is it just like casually sit back and let the magic take care of us? Or is it our engagement with magic that makes it work? I recently heard something like, I don't know if this is true, but it might be, that of all the major world religions and spiritual traditions, Buddha, Dharma may be the only one that, at least originally, didn't rely on any like larger external power or being. It's very like was very self-reliant. You just have to do this practice and just follow these steps. It's just the way the mind works. And then later, Buddhism brought in more like, you know, archetypal bodhisattvas and Buddhas, like Amitabha Buddha and Dharma protectors and so on. Because we like relating to something larger. But it may be that it, at its foundations, it may have been the only tradition that was very much about self-reliance in an almost scientific kind of way. So these two types of grasping, this, the grasping of the view of the independent self, and the grasping of, we could also call it the view that particular precepts and practices in and of themselves will lead to complete freedom. It's said that when those two types of grasping are let go of, kind of understood and released, which is how often letting go is not so much like, just try to let go. It's more like, just see really clearly, oh, something's being held here. What's going on there? Let's take a little look. And it's almost, it's not so much a we do this work of letting go. The most deepest level, I think, is just clear seeing, discernment and wisdom, the hold releases. And so when these two release, as well as all the any doubts that this is kind of the way to freedom, those two types of grasping and any kind of doubt drop away. That's what's said to be called in the early Buddhist teachings, stream entry. One enters the stream of practice and it's irreversible. One can never escape practice anymore. We can try our darndest to distract ourselves, but it's too late at that point. Because it's like, particularly this part about the independent self, when it's that seen through on a really deep level, it's like, you see there's everything else, then you see like all, you know, greed and hate can still continue, but it's like, it doesn't make any more sense. And you see, this is the key principle for freedom here, the liberating principle. And then it's almost like still there's a lot of work to do, but it's a natural evolution, according to the Buddhist teachings. And the more work to do is these other types of grasping. And so the third one is grasping sense pleasure. I brought this up in a group the other day, and at this one somebody said, "Oh no." And I said, "Yeah, I agree." This one, so hard. And it's interesting that, you know, one can enter the stream and have this deep insight into no independent self and still be totally into holding on to sense pleasure, because it's even deeper, is my understanding. We're wired to like the pleasant and dislike the unpleasant. So to rewire our system like this is traditionally said to take a long time. After the insight that it's basically illusory wiring, it's kind of, the wiring is based on false premises, still, it's like heavy-duty wiring. So, and this doesn't mean that the Buddha doesn't say that pleasure is bad. Sometimes it could get interpreted that way. I think it's really important to understand that's not what it means. And the Buddha did teach in the early sutras a lot about kind of like steer away from where you get really involved in pleasure. And he was kind of an austere ascetic himself, right? And I think it was just because, sense pleasure is very dangerous because it's so easy to attach to. So just, if you're just trying to get a foothold in the practice, really take a look at that and try to set up a situation where you're not constantly tempted. But then as time goes on, we might be able to really start just investigating it more, be really aware, here's pleasure. Pleasure comes. I think the Buddha experienced pleasure and pain. But then do we hold it? Do we grasp it? Do we say, like, please let this never end? Or can I have some more? And we know how we do this in infinite ways. And I think our practice, not so much like we got to stop doing this, but really study it thoroughly. How do I hold on it? And basically, and again, there's nothing like kind of evil about grasping. It's just that it's suffering and it binds us in our habitual patterns. So just looking clearly, like, in the song of the trusting mind, we say the great way is without difficulty for those who hold no preferences. We can have preferences, just let's not hold them too tightly. If we do, it's just that the great way will then become difficult. That's the only problem with it. Also in that song of the trusting mind, in the part later that we don't chant in the mornings, this is the third Zen ancestor. He says something like, if you want to practice the one vehicle, don't be averse to the sensory realm. So in Zen, they often turn it like this. As a response to these early teachings of be careful of sense pleasure, the Zen people make this little correction and say, don't be averse to pleasure and the senses. Enjoy it fully, just be careful. We don't grab hold of it too strongly. Because in a way, aversion and grasping are just two forms of the same thing. The two ways we're not just settled into the experience that's happening. So, grasping the pleasure that comes through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. And not being averse or running away from the pleasure that comes through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. And when unpleasant comes through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, we just, okay, unpleasant. So much of our practice is actually working with this. Just zazen, you could say zazen is working with all four of these graspings, but this one, it's uncomfortable sitting here for 40 minutes without moving, but it's okay. I can sit here. It's okay to sit when it's uncomfortable. If it's really painful, we can move, but just to sit when it's uncomfortable, I would say, is really a training and working with, like, this type of grasping to the body sense pleasure of standing up when we're uncomfortable. It's okay. Just acceptance of the pleasure and pain that's coming and going. So then the fourth grasping is grasping all other kinds of views. Just to be all-inclusive, we have the view of the independent self. It's a really big one. Gets its own category. because maybe all other views are often revolve around that one or emanations from that one, including the view that certain practices are good enough, are all that's needed. Because it's like good enough for me, right? If I just practice the precepts completely, I will become free. This is a self thing going on there too. So this other kind of, you're grasping all other kinds of views are just, the Buddha was really into like looking at all these different kinds of philosophical views that are kind of not in accord with reality. And, you know, for like the big ones are that this world truly exists in and of itself is a kind of view that we're pretty much all grasp almost continuously because we feel like it does. But then there's another view that like this world doesn't exist at all. There's nothing at all here. That's another extreme view that you can grasp, like eternalism and nihilism. So there's a middle way that's not grasping those extreme views. In one of the early teachings, the Buddha said, when we see that the world comes to be, we know that we can't grasp the view that there is no world. And we see that the world ceases each moment, our experience ceases, then we can't grasp the view that it exists in some eternal, permanent and essential way. That's a very simple way to look at it. It's arising, so that's not like nothing. And it's ceasing, so that's not like something substantial. It's kind of simple reasoning. And all the other views that derive from that, which cause lots of disputes and arguments, and even just little views like, you know, it's better to have raised platforms in the Zendo than to sit on the floor. I might hold that view a little bit. I think it's really cool we have raised platforms. I used to sit on the floor here. It's a little like if I really hold that view, and then somebody says, but in this small Zendo, platforms won't fit in here or something. Then we'll get really disturbed. But it's better to have raised platforms. So any kind of the Buddha's like, I don't hold any particular position. It might look like he does because he's giving all these teachings, but he's not holding any particular position about things. Very kind of flexibly can respond. So then if somebody really gets into it, it's not that way, Buddha. The Buddha's like, okay. It's very hard, I think, to do. Not hold any views. So these are four types of grasping. When released through discernment and wisdom, there's the sun of Buddha nature just shines brightly. These are like the clouds that can fall away. So it's not so much that we have to create some kind of freedom or even like eradicate grasping. It's another kind of view. I think that would be a view that we could grasp. All grasping must be eradicated. Right now, I decree. That would be kind of like grasping a fixed view. It's more like these things that we're grasping aren't actually graspable. It's another way to look at it from a kind of Zen perspective. If they were really graspable, then we might not be able to ever let go. But if we look really closely, there's nothing there to grasp, but we have to look deeply and carefully and ongoingly. So deep our grasping, so vast our freedom, so possible because we're already fully endowed with perfect wisdom and compassion of a Buddha. It's just like these clouds are so alluring. They seem so real. So, any questions? Yes.
Is it possible to have a view you without grasping.
Mm.
Like, momentarily.
Yeah.
I don't like the tongues that yeah. I and I let it go.
Yeah, I think quite an interesting question, actually. I think there's some debate about that within the tradition, even about like Nagarjuna, who's kind of like the master spokesman for relinquishing all extreme views, which is basically almost any view. So sometimes it looks, people will say, Nagarjuna didn't have any view. He was just refuting all other views and not setting up one of his own. That's one interpretation of Nagarjuna. And then another interpretation is he was actually offering a view, like, for example, the middle way is a kind of a view, or dependent co-arising is a kind of a view, and it looks like Nagarjuna is teaching that. So that would be one example of is it possible to maybe have a view that's barely a view and to not hold it? Now, is it possible to have a more extreme view and not hold it? Maybe, experientially, we could even say I have the view that bodhisattva precepts are definitely will lead to liberation quicker than Hinayana precepts, or something like that. I really hold that view. I really have that view. And can we have that view without holding it? Maybe.
I have sort of an example. So back when I was reading Trust and Mind, I did a little experiment, and I went to Pan's ice cream line.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'm not going to look at the ice cream, just give me whatever. And they're like, you sure you don't want to say it? No, really, just cone, cup, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, you take it. And
great practice.
It gave me something, and it ended up being strawberry peppercorn. And so what happened with in terms of pleasure and unpleasure, I sort of was tasting the ice cream and I said, oh, strawberries and peppercorns don't really go together. And so I found it. This was an unpleasant taste.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't attaching to this is an unpleasant taste.
Yeah, I think it's more with this thing of attaching to pleasant or unpleasant. I think that's the one where it's less about a view. I think the other three are kind of like views, but my understanding is that one's, it's more raw and basic than even a view. It's not so much attaching to the view that pleasure is better. I think it's really then we're really working with direct grasping of the actual experience of pleasure. We're holding to that. It's a mental phenomena, like view is a mental phenomena. Pleasure is a mental phenomena, a feeling. But I think we're grasping it directly. So in that case, I think we might even we might be able to eat the peppercorn, strawberry without grasping, wishing that we were eating the vanilla or something. Or, what is it exactly that we call grasping is another interesting question. I think it's just more like a more like solidification of wanting. Maybe like that, like I really want, or I just want, I would rather have the vanilla, but then I really rather have the vanilla. It's like it's a tighter hold. Or like, I'm gonna get the vanilla. Maybe that's one, I've heard one teacher define it that way. It's when you decide you're gonna get it. It's like you're gonna hold it. It's like a further contraction. But I think it's possible, yeah, to just eat the peppercorn and really not prefer it, but it's okay. A little bit like it's uncomfortable to sit here, but it's okay. Then we could have the view that I don't know if it's even, Buddha maybe doesn't get into these kind of views so much, like vanilla is better than strawberry. I mean, it is kind of a view, I think.
The view is that they don't go together.
Oh, that they don't go together, yeah, yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
I don't know about for all people.
Yeah, well, I think,
I was like, wow, it really, it's just like strawberry and peppercorn.
It is a strange combination, it sounds to me. But I think in that case, it's also like for me. That would be one way to let maybe be able to release the view is like, I really just don't go together for me. But since they keep, since they've made a whole 5-gallon vat of this flavor, somebody probably thinks they go together. Or maybe it's the first vat they've ever made and it's an experiment that will miserably fail. But probably somebody will think it's interesting. But for me, yeah, the view is like that for me they don't go together. I think we can have that view. Kind of it's just a kind of a fact about this body and mind karmic setup here seems to not like that combination. And we do have different likes and dislikes. I think that's fine too. I think the Buddha actually preferred hanging out with Ananda. He's like, he had Ananda was like his attendant, like his whole life, apparently, or from pretty early on, for many decades, he never switched the jisha. And it's like, well, isn't that kind of preferential? Shouldn't you give somebody else a chance? Maybe it wasn't his preference. Maybe it was just like, Ananda really needs like close attention because he's kind of a wild character. So we don't know. But it may be that we have a good karmic connection here. It's okay. I relate to the other students in different ways. You know, I don't know. Can we call Buddha? Is he grasping Ananda a little bit there? Did somebody have a question? Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. I caught many things in the photo as well. Clinging to views that I thought of one in the Heart Sutra, path. When I first saw that, I'm going to believe the path. But now I think I understand a little more. And what helped with that is the clinging even to the Dharma in the sense of the wrath, this fierce river. Fierce river of the meaning of the samsara and stuff. The Dharma is that wrath to get across the river, and it's kind of foolish to get up to the other shore, like they say, whatever that is, words, you seem words when you point to it. But to carry that
once you get to the other shore, yes.
So now I understand that a little bit more, and I think that would be the idea of this clinging to precepts and practice. You won't get to it. Yes, you're clinging.
Or once something is.
But that's what it brought into mind. I haven't thought about it in so long. Now it used to. It broke my heart. I saw that now.
Yeah, great example. Yeah, once some practice does its work, you maybe don't need to cling to it. And then, in Zen tradition, with Dogen in particular, he would criticize some people who'd say, some other Zen teachers in his time would say, like, well, you just Zazen is a means to an end, and once you realize it's all empty through the practice of Zazen, then you don't need to sit anymore. And Dogen's like, that's a totally holding a false view. He's like, it's an endless practice. You never, because practice itself is manifesting this freedom. So it's not a means to an end. It's just a continuous practice. And then the Buddha was like living out in the forest, and some people said, why do you you're free from everything. You can't you're unable to grasp anything anymore because you've seen through the illusion of this world. So like, why don't you move back into the palace again, and have a comfy life there? Now that you won't grasp it. And the Buddha's like, I'm sort of paraphrasing a little bit. He's like, yeah, it's true. I wouldn't grasp it, but one thing, I prefer the forest. That's just lovely because it's so simple out here. Once I get back to the palace, it's like a lot of like duties and stuff. It's going to be rough. I like living in the woods. So in a way, you could say he had that preference. He said, the Buddha said he likes something. I prefer living in the woods. So, but was he holding that? No, you really should go back to the palace. Oh, okay. But then, secondly, I like to I live in the forest because I'm setting an example for future generations. It's like I don't really need to do this, but it's nice to keep showing this path that worked for me, even though I've let go of that raft now. Yeah. But it's true, the Heart Sutra is a great example of all, any one of the long list in the Heart Sutra of all those things with the no before them are like, those could be all kind of views that we hold. Like, there really is an I organ, right? No, there's no I. Okay, there really is ignorance, right? No, there's no ignorance. There really is old age and death. No old age and death. So and for you, it's like the path was the one that caught you. It's really nice. But for each of us, it might be, we can, you know, what's our favorite? Our which part of the Heart Sutra do we have the biggest problem with? No suffering? Okay, I'll go with that one. But no path or no cessation of suffering? I don't know about that. Yeah, it's like a litany of all the views that could be held, and Buddha says, no. Okay. So I will keep studying these types of grasping in this body and mind experience. I vow to study them for the rest of this life if they arise, and as they arise, and really try to investigate this, and for the benefit of everyone. May this merit equally extend everywhere. Vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.